This is the old Good Morning Man, Kermit Edney, with program number 135 in a series of 260 chapters into the happenings and the people who made things happen here over the past 50 years, the WHKP years from 1946. We follow the same format as the Great Frank Fitzsimmons series, so we simply call it Where Fitz Left Off. And today, a final chapter into the triple murder in Henderson County 30 years ago this week, which is still unsolved. Being able to look back in retrospect with facts that have aged over a three-decade period gives one an opportunity to ruminate freely without debate or rebuttal. The investigation began as a joint project of the city police, the county sheriff's department, assisted by local agents of the SBI. The only statement Chief Powers made on his own was before the bodies had been discovered, and he was reporting only that his department was searching for the two missing men. Thereafter, Powered made statements to the press only on a joint basis with the Sheriff's Department. However, as the days dragged on, it became apparent there no longer existed joint cooperation, and the various departments were moving on their own with little or no coordination or communication. This is best evidenced in an interview with the Times News on the phone on August 4th, when Sheriff Hill was in Asheville and was at the time in the offices of Buncombe County Sheriff Harry Clay. At this time, the sheriff announced he had secured the services of a Florida investigator by the name of Ed Stanton. The very next day, the SBI tried to bring the parties back together again by renting a cottage on North Carolina 191, which would be used as headquarters for the investigation. And the SBI said that in the future there would be no statements issued except on a joint basis from this new headquarters site. The next day, the SBI announced they had transferred to the case Agent Jim Maxey of Bryson City and Agent Jack Peacock of Hickory to augment the efforts of P.R. Kitchen, SBI supervisor, and Special Agents Gary Satterfield and Claude Davis. That was August 6, and that was the last official release of any kind on this case through the entire year of 1966. And in 1967, the Times News merely reported the triple murders as being one of the top 52 stories of the preceding year. Now, the editor of the local weekly, the Tribune, kept trying to keep interest drummed up with all sorts of tabloid-type rumors, but basically, as every new lead dried up, investigating officers gradually lost interest, and the case was finally designated unsolved. Looking back 30 years ago, the public was told of the penchants of Glass for voodooism and the occult. But in 1966, the rule now used only in the military, don't display it, don't tell, that rule was in force across the nation. While the public was aware of the rumors of homosexuality on the part of Glass and Shipman, there was no mention of this in any police statement. The public also talked freely about directories of homosexuals found in the personal possessions of one of those involved. Neither Glass nor Shipman were married, and Mrs. Shoemate was only reported to have been seen in the company of one man and on an infrequent basis by those who knew her. She had visited Glass in Pardee Hospital when he was recuperating from a broken bone he had suffered at a party around New Year's Day. The investigators did report that the three bodies had been placed in a 10-foot semicircle and that some type of cross had been created and placed on each body. In Glass's case, his crutches, Mrs. Shoemate had a liquor bottle, Shipman a piece of iron. One of the SBI agents, Gary Satterfield, and I had a number of off-the-record conversations over coffee. And Gary, after about a month had gone by, had written off any hope of ever solving the crime. He blamed over-eager and untrained officers for certain no-nos at the crime scene when first discovered. He was very disgusted with the unilateral activities going on among the various departments. He emphasized that the investigators were trying to solve the triple killings as being the result of normal behavior. He emphasized that whoever was responsible for this ghastly crime did not act alone. He said it is obvious that those who aided or were present that night were more afraid of the perpetrator than they were of the police. He said, I'm no psychologist, but the person responsible achieved some special satisfaction in what he had done. And so far, we've not been able to establish meaning to the peculiarities evident at this crime scene. He mused further, you take one of these migrant labor contractors. Some of them have several killings under their belt, and in some cases were never brought to trial. The migrants who they have recruited do not even have the rights of slaves before the Civil War. Some of these migrant bosses, he said, look upon these people as animals, and with others who they do not agree with their morals also as little more than animals. But in other areas, he said, they feel morally superior. He said simply because they don't commit the usual Saturday night sins and they feel that they follow the Ten Commandments, when they have killed, they viewed the victim only as an animal. Gary paused, and I said, what you're saying is that you believe the whole thing was engineered by a particularly vicious migrant boss? Absolutely. And one that's so mean, the people who know him are more afraid of him than they are of the law. Gary went on to say he only hoped that before the perpetrator died, he would leave an explanatory note documenting what he had done so the case could be put to rest. It never has been. Memories of a seventh child of a seventh child. Lucky enough to have been born here. The good sense never to leave with the job he's loved all of his life. Sursum corda, as we approach the next 50 years.